This was certainly a delightful book. I think I read it in one sitting, maybe a sitting and a half.
Oh, thank you.
And when I do that, that shows that I am absorbed, and I certainly was when I read Whitetown Drowsing. So I want to ask you a little bit about Hannibal and about yourself and about how the book came into being. Now, you left Hannibal when you were 17, so your formative years were spent there. What was growing up like in Hannibal, Missouri?
Well, I think any kid who grew up there, especially in the late 40s and early 50s, before television became as dominant as it is now, had a very special sense of being in the center of things. Even though we were in a small town out there on the prairie, at least 100 miles from any large city, we could walk down Hill Street on a summer afternoon, where the Mark Twain boyhood home is, and look at the license plates on the cars that had come to see us. We'd see Delaware and California and New York, and we hadn't been to any of those places, but they had come to see us. And that sort of reinforced the mythic power of Mark Twain, the man who put Hannibal on the map. That combined with the physical beauty of the town, the majesty of the river, and the loveliness of those green bluffs that the town is nestled between, made it a lyric and very happy place to grow up.
Yes, the shadow of Mark Twain hangs over Hannibal, probably forever. In what ways is Hannibal influenced by that mythic literary figure?
I write in the book that Mark Twain blessed and cursed Hannibal with his legacy, much as the Mississippi River blessed and cursed the town by being there. The blessing in the river's case is that it's beautiful, it carries commerce in and out of town, and it inspires a very romantic feeling about the town. The cursing is that it floods and ruins the whole area of commerce that grew up alongside its banks. In Twain's case, in Sam Clemens's case, the blessing was that he indelibly imprinted Hannibal, probably forever, on the nation's sort of mythic memory. I mean, a lot of people who have never been to Hannibal feel as if they had been. I sense this when I talk to people and tell them where I'm from. The curse is that, in a sense, the Mark Twain legacy becomes something that a town like Hannibal clings to in an age in which its natural economy is gone. Like a lot of river towns, Hannibal is struggling. It's bleeding economically. So here is that sort of brass ring of the Mark Twain legacy that perhaps the town always feels it can capitalize on if it promotes the tourist industry. And to an extent that works, but to a larger extent it doesn't, and it only frustrates the people who aren't making any money off the Mark Twain name and to whom that image is just something that stares at them from the back of a produce truck.
So there's a Becky Thatcher restaurant and Mark Twain Theater.
You don't know the half of it. When I was a kid, there was a Tom Sawyer Theater and a Huck Finn Burger Bar and an Injun Joe Motel. Why anybody would stay at the Injun Joe is beyond me, but they did. Yes, there's a lot of attempts to capitalize on that brand name, some of which, by the way, are fairly tastefully done. One of the central families that I write about in Whitetown Drowsing is the family of my best friend Delaney Winkler. His parents and grandparents and great-grandparents made their money in the lumber fortune that surged through Hannibal at the turn of the century, and they used a lot of that money to sort of hand the boyhood home and the museum and some parks and some other historic mementos over to the town. And in a very tasteful way, Delaney's father became the curator of the museum and the custodian of the really respectful image of Mark Twain. So that does exist. This carefully cultivated little museum that has his typewriter. I used to write Mark Twain, or used to write Tom Sawyer with, a lock of his hair, the baccalaureate robes, and some of his papers. It is truly exciting to go in there. It's not so exciting to go next door and look at the haunted house on Hill Street with the mechanical vultures and the bumper stickers, but that's an inevitable price we pay in this century, and in a sense, that's what the book is about.
Now, you went away. You went to St. Louis, was it?
Well, I went to school at my family moved. My father, the Fuller Brush Man, moved us out of town when I was 17. He felt that he had sort of Don Hannibal with his brushes, and he moved the family to Jefferson City, Missouri, the capital of the state. So then I went on to college and got my first newspaper job in St. Louis and sort of headed north and east after that.
So some 25 years passed since the time you actually lived in Hannibal. Did you go back at all during that 25-year period?
I did. I didn't go back very often because, for one thing, Hannibal is not easy to get to if you're not trying. You don't go through Hannibal on your way to someplace else. It's where you're going to end up. It's out there on Tulane blacktops. My family lived a couple of, 100 miles away, so when I came back to visit my parents in Missouri, I would have to bypass Hannibal. It was always there, and I always felt that I could go back and re-enter this very happy childhood that I had. But outside of 6 or 7 occasions, I really didn't. So when my first son was born, which happened on my 40th birthday, November 18th, by the way.
I'll remember that.
When he was born, a lot of memories came flooding back that I didn't even know I had. I started to think about what was special about being a boy in a town. And it took the form of remembering what night was like as opposed to urban darkness lit by neon. And how the smell of a town changed from season to season. The crab apples in the fall and the cut grass in the spring. All of these things were important to me. And I wanted to at least give my children a record. And that's what got me going back to Hannibal, simply to refresh my memory. But I happened to hit the town at a very decisive year in its history.
Well, you went back in 1984.
85.
85, wasn't it?
Right.
But it was to jar the town's image in your memory, but it was also a sociological mission because you had an intention to do something with this experience of going back, didn't you?
Well, I had heard that the town was gearing up to celebrate the 150th birthday of Mark Twain. And the sociological factors that came into play, I guess, were that I was aware that late 20th century marketing schemes were going to be brought into play. They were going to hire, in fact, they did hire, an Eastern consultant who specialized in commemorations and anniversary centennials. They brought this guy into town. In fact, he approached them first. Hannibal came up in his Rolodex, and he said, aha. He wrote them a letter and said, in effect, follow my blueprint for mounting a sesquicentennial festival, and I will make you $250 million in tourist economy that will ripple through the state. That was sort of the apple in the Garden of Eden that triggered a lot of unfortunate things in Hannibal.
Well, you went back, and obviously you had not spent a great deal of time there over the previous 25 years, so you must have found some changes in Hannibal. What were they, if any? Or did it indeed remain the idyllic location of your childhood?
That was the scariest thing. The town looked almost exactly as it looked when I left. If you go out to the edge of town, you'll find the shopping centers. New houses have been built. And as you go down Main Street, that big broad swath of pavement that heads directly down until it dips under the Mississippi River, yes, buildings have been torn down. The Tom Sawyer Theater is no longer a theater. A lot of the dress shops and the family-owned merchant shops are boarded up or changed into something franchisey. But through that, the essence of Hannibal, the cracks in the sidewalk that I remembered, the levee, where the Mississippi came, rippling up, very much the same. A lot of the neighborhoods on the sides of hills probably hadn't had a coat of paint since I left. But there is kind of a gothic and mysterious charm in all of that. But let's be honest that the town isn't doing all that well. And that's one reason that it hadn't changed. You know, when Mark Twain was writing Huckleberry Finn in the 1870s, most of the storefronts that are still up on North Main Street were up then. Hannibal has never been able to afford a building boom.
That's not untypical of small-town America,
true.
Is it?
Not untypical. And in a sense, I mean, it's almost selfish for people like me who have left to want those buildings to still be there. But they do lend a kind of authenticity that a shopping center can't confer.
Well, apparently, as you went back to Hannibal on repeated visits and the plans for the sesquicentennial escalated, some of those plans got out of hand.
They
became overly ambitious.
Tell me
a little bit about that.
Well, it was interesting because Hannibal, I mean, Hannibal needed a quick fix. Hannibal was, and the city fathers of Hannibal were looking for a kind of magical solution to these economic problems. Loss of factories, loss of the railroad trade, the cement company was gone. All of these things were happening to Hannibal, and it was not Hannibal's fault. It's just the century had bypassed this town, as it had a lot of other towns, which made the young mayor and the newspaper publisher and the Chamber of Commerce people sort of look around and see, what can we do to recover some kind of vitality? Ah, the sesquicentennial. We'll create, and the consultant was whispering in their ear all this time, we'll create a sort of a seven-month-long mini World's Fair, and we'll bring in rock concerts, and we'll have a riverboat regatta. We'll have a Good Golly Aunt Polly rock and roll revival, and we'll get people dressed up in styrofoam frog suits for the celebrated jumping frog. And we will turn Hannibal into a theme park. We'll make it a kind of a caricature of itself. The tourists will come, they'll buy the t-shirts and bumper stickers, and we'll make a lot of money. As it turned out, that quick fix wasn't a fix at all, because it clashed with the old-time temperament of Hannibal. And here's what made it almost eerie for me. When I became a journalist and became interested in television, the first book I ever wrote was about market research and about consultants as they applied to the broadcasting business. And then I watched this kind of fad of consultants spread into politics. I mean, political candidates are being advised by experts. We all know that now. Education, industry, the whole realm of ideas is being invaded by these outside value-free experts. All of a sudden, here comes this cloud to my ancestral turf. The consultants are where I grew up, and they're going to say, you know, listen to us, folks. We're going to make you stars. And it didn't work for Hannibal any more than it worked really for any other realm
that I followed. The town became divided. How did that happen?
It was very tragic. The people of Hannibal found, for one thing, that to their surprise, the sesquicentennial was too big for them. The mayor was saying, in effect, to the guy who owned the local Kentucky Fried Chicken franchise, thanks for offering us $500, but it's not enough. We're going to go to St. Louis, and we're going to get the Pet Corporation, the McDonald's people, I mean, the aircraft McDonald's, to give us tens of thousands of dollars, and we're going to take this whole show downtown. We're going to create pavilions, we're going to create attractions, brand name acts, and television is going to come to Hannibal, and we're going to be on Good Morning America, and we're too big for you, sorry. Well, that had the effect of telling the grassroots people of Hannibal that this wasn't their festival. They were there as props. They were there to be, you know, part of the show, but they didn't really have anything to do with it. And then, the zinger, I guess, happened when these delegations came back from Pet and McDonald without any contributions, because the vice presidents in charge of donations had looked at their plan and said, how many hotels do you have? Well, we have a Holiday Inn, but you expect 1 million people. What are you going to do? We'll work on that and get back to you tomorrow.
Well, Quincy had two Holiday Inns.
Quincy, a little town across the river. So they had a plan to sort of have a shuttle service of little cars shuttling back and forth between Hannibal and Quincy. It never had a chance. It cost the town its sort of brilliant, ambitious young mayor. They voted him out of office because he became the scapegoat, really, because he was the one who promised the town everything. It quickly became apparent this wasn't going to happen. He was replaced by a man who had taught kindergarten, ran a photography store, and was a member of a fundamentalist church who never before had even thought about public office. And thereupon ensued the nervous breakdown of Hannibal.
What they wanted, apparently, was a fair that perhaps would equal the size of the Seattle World's Fair or the New York World's Fair, but the town could not support such a venture, could it?
No, it couldn't. they wanted, they, I guess, meaning Mayor John Ling, the newspaper publisher, and the consultants who came in, they envisioned something fairly small but nifty that would attract national attention over a period of 7 months. They expected to have a parade a day, fireworks display every week, men dressed up as Mark Twain telling stories for thousands of people, croquet tournaments, all of these things. What they did not take into account was the ancient temperament of this town, which is really a southern colony. I mean, it's not geographically very far south, but it's a town that was formed in the 1820s and 1830s when Sam Clemens' father, Judge Clemens, got up and out of Virginia and migrated north to sort of find new opportunities and a new way of life. He never found that, but he was part of the settlement that brought with them their southern customs, their speech patterns, their zodiac signs, their cooking recipes. And because Hannibal is so isolated, it was being on just to the west of the Mississippi, it was the banks of the wilderness. And it was left untouched for most of its history. And the town has that charming innocence about it still that became its downfall.
Now, you, Ron Powers, you went back, and all of a sudden there was an observer in their midst, one not completely unfamiliar to them, and yet many years had passed since you had been there. And here you were monitoring what was going on and taking notes. How did you fit in as all this was going on?
I never stopped asking myself that, and I felt very, very self-conscious. There were times when I didn't want to walk out on the street. I usually come into town, I'd have a rented car, and I'd put up at a guest house, restored an old Victorian house somewhere in town. And I came there feeling very naked, very conspicuous, because I knew I was going to run into old friends and relatives, and they were going to say, "What are you doing here?" And then I'd say, "Well, I'm here as a journalist." And that was so artificial. And then I also wondered, how are the people of Hannibal going to feel when they read what I've written? I mean, they took a lot of darts and jokes at their expense in that summer. And how bad would it be if the last slap in the face was delivered by the kid who left town and came back as a smart city slicker? I tried very hard not to have that quality in my book.
They got used to your presence, though.
They did. In fact, I was very... The fact that Hannibal is an old-fashioned town worked to my advantage because, you know, these people knew that I was there to write critically about something very convulsive that had happened to them. And they would have been, in my opinion, very well justified in saying, "Thanks, but no comment."
Of course, you weren't exactly anonymous. You even made a presentation at the local college.
That's true. I did. I participated in a writer's conference at the local college and stood up in my new seersucker suit and pontificated all these people. But because I was a son of the town, they accepted me, and I found it very touching. So part of my odyssey back to Hannibal was to see what was happening, and another part of it was to see whether I could, in fact, re-enter these old rhythms and part those invisible curtains and be a boy in the town again. And in that, I was, let's say, less than half successful.
Well, the sesquicentennial did go ahead, kind of a scaled-down version, but it wasn't too bad, was it?
In the end, it turned out to be a fairly reasonable celebration. It was about the kind of celebration that Hannibal should have looked forward to from the beginning. And I think if it hadn't been for all of the raised hopes and then the sort of dashed promises of all these riches and things that were going to happen, it would have been a successful year. But the fact that the big money never came there made the sesquicentennial almost a fable, a morality play of what happens a lot in America when we try to cash in on the past, our authentic tradition, and turn it into a kind of roadside attraction.
Does Hannibal learn any lessons?
Well, they like the book.
that was my next question. First, did they learn anything from their experience?
That doesn't mean they learned anything. I've since heard, and I've been in touch with. I've made a lot of friends in Hannibal, and I've been on the phone with them a lot since the book was published. And Yes and no is the answer. I mean, there's now a plan afoot in Hannibal to build a new motel down on the riverfront. That's nice, but they want it to be in the shape of a steamboat up on a concrete block so the floodwaters won't get it, and a curved bottom and a paddle wheel, probably all made out of molded plastic. So in my opinion, that's not a good indication that they've learned anything. On the other hand, I sympathize with them. You've got to keep trying. When a town runs out of money, runs out of its economy, you can't tear down the buildings and put them in orange crate box and tell the people to move someplace else. You've got to go on being a town. So there's something poignant about these constant attempts to rebuild that Mark Twain tourist legacy.
Have you been back since the book was published?
Yes, I did. I went back for a signing. And
you weren't stoned?
No, I felt sort of like I remember Floyd Patterson after he used to fight his heavyweight bouts. He'd leave the arena in the phony glasses and mustache, especially if he lost. And I thought maybe that's the way I ought to come into Hannibal as a gag. But to my immense gratification, the people of Hannibal chose to believe that the book was affirmative, and I think it was. But they didn't see it as the kind of smart aleck slap in the face that perhaps they might have. They chose to believe it was... because I think there is a lot of love for the town that comes through in the pages. And what pleased me was that even the people who were sort of spotlighted as having made wrong decisions, the mayor who was defeated, the newspaper publisher who became the chairman of the Sesquicentennial, were kind. The newspaper publisher had the book reviewed. And... that made me feel real good.
Well, my last question, Ron Powers. I think in the book you talk about, could I go back? Could I take my family back? Could I work there? Could I exist in Hannibal, Missouri?
Yeah.
Well, what was your conclusion?
I can't. As I wrote the book and as I reported the book, I felt this tension between a love of the past that can easily turn into nostalgia. A love of the past is fine. We learn from it, and we ought to remember what has happened, where we came from. It's very important, I think, to keep that sense of history alive. When you try to re-enter it and create a golden age that comes out of your memory, I think you're headed for trouble. I'm not the same person as I was when I left Hannibal. Sometimes that makes me feel sad, but it's true. And in a more practical sense, I'm not sure it would be fair to take my children back and have them grow up in the town as the kids of that guy who wrote the Hannibal book. That wouldn't be a fair legacy to them.
Ron Powers, it's a wonderful book. Thank you very much.
Thank you.